When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Mr. Brian Reese.
Here we are now.
Are we going to entertain them?
We will.
Today on the program, we will be discussing Canada's Finest, the wonderful run of John Byrne's Alpha Flight. Before that, I want to kind of continue a conversation we started from last time, Brian.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So last time we were together, we had mentioned, as you recall, Brian, I'm sure you remember when you re-listened to our last episode.
Right. When I listened to it, yes.
Yes. We had talked about DC's new All In initiative.
Yes.
Which was going to have sort of a, not a reboot, but a starting off point for different comics so that new readers can jump in.
And I want to interject here real quick. Since we've spoken, they have introduced some new series that are really exciting. I don't know if this will work, but good for them.
I do want to throw out there, Rom V doing New Gods. So excited.
Yeah.
Because if anyone can make New Gods work, it's Rom V.
He's right in his wheelhouse, knowing his work outside of DC even, but just his work with mythology and lore and things like that.
It's hard to, I mean, I guess we're going to go off on a tangent. It's hard to get Kirby's stuff to work because Kirby's work is quintessentially Kirby. I mean, even he struggled to make it work sometimes.
Kirby, not a great writer.
No, but a great, great, great ideas.
A great storyteller.
Great storyteller, great ideas, great concepts. You know, like if you take the Eternals, no one has been able to make the Eternals work. Even, I hesitate to say his name, even Gaiman couldn't get the Eternals to really work. Except Kieran Gillen came along and did something interesting.
Again, a writer uniquely positioned to tackle that sort of concept.
Exactly. So I have high hopes for Rom V doing the same thing, taking a concept like the New Gods, which, with the exception of Darkseid, people have had a really hard time making work.
Yeah.
Well, maybe Tom King. Tom King made it work.
Yeah. I mean, it's that was a fun, you're talking about Mr. Miracle.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that was a fun series, although weird.
Right. Here's hoping that Rom V makes it weird. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about, Brian.
We're here to talk about...
discussion of you know, starting fresh.
It's germane to our comic that we're talking about, too. So, yes.
I totally planned it that way.
Yes, I'm sure you did.
Yeah, so in our discussion last time, you had used, as an example, X-Men and how it's impossible to just get into X-Men. There's no jumping on point. And here we are, a mere few weeks later, and we've got a few jumping on points. So that's what I wanted to talk about. At the time of this recording, three new kind of fresh restarts of X-Men have started. And they are Regular X-Men, No Adjective X-Men by Jed McKay and Ron Stegman, Uncanny X-Men by Gail Simone and David Marquez, and X-Factor by Mark Russell and Bob Quinn. Again, right now, those are the only three X-Men titles. In about a week, there's going to be 16 more or something like that. But for right now, so we've read all these. Am I correct?
We have. I have, for the first time in lo these many years, read some X-Men comics.
So that's what I wanted to talk about. I want to get your opinion. How do you feel about this new launching point for the X-Men?
Well, it's interesting. So I figured I'd give it a try because this felt like a harder reset than when Hickman came in. Because I love Hickman in some of his stuff, but I didn't feel like when he took over the X-Men that it was going to be a good starting point. And from everything I've read and heard, I wasn't necessarily wrong.
I enjoyed that. I enjoyed Hickman's run, but he did Hickmanize it to the point where he had a complex system and and charts and graphs and stuff. So not for the casual reader.
Yes, it really didn't feel like a good jumping. And to be clear, ever, you know, I read the X-Men through the 80s into the early 90s. And I think I just gave up when I was in college and didn't have $500 to buy 1,000 different titles.
Right. Well, that's when its popularity started to get so big that that's right. when it started ballooning out of control.
Yeah. And I just was like, I can't keep track of this. I don't know who this, that, or the other is. And I quit. You know, I was like,
right.
I was like, ooh, what is this shiny thing that DC is doing called Vertigo? Whatever.
I'll just admit it. When I was in college, I hit my pretentious arty mode. So
yes,
I'm only going to read Vertigo in independent comics. Thank you very much.
Yes.
X-Men, how you feeling?
Well, my initial plan, let's be honest, who can sell me a comic book? Gail Simone. Gosh, I like everything she writes. And Advanced Word was this really was an opportunity for lapsed Catholics or lapsed
ex-Mennonites.
Ex-Mennonites to try to jump back on. So I gave Uncanny X-Men a try. And the best part about it was I knew all of the characters except for maybe one. Because one of the things about the X-Men is, my God, there were thousands, thousands, thousands of them. I don't know how people keep track. I honestly don't know how people keep track. Even in the comics I read regularly, if it's been 10 years since a character was introduced and they go away and then they come back, I'm like, who the hell was that? And when I have to try to keep track of a cast of thousands. So the first thing is, like, Uncanny was accessible. A core cast with a singular mission. And of course, you just have the great dialogue. You have the great plotting. Art looked good. I was like, I can follow this. I feel as if what I didn't know, Simone did a great job of not over-explaining, but just giving me enough. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. I wholeheartedly concur. Gail Simone is amazing.
Yeah.
She was able to get everybody up to speed through dialogue. Now, I'm going to talk about this in a second. Jed McKay does the same thing in a different way. Mm-hmm. Not a bad way, but in a different way. But yeah, I know what you mean. A core cast of recognizable characters, popular fan favorite characters too.
Very, very much so. And, you know, characters that I love, like I'm over Wolverine. I'm going to reference him later. So we'll get into that. But you know, Rogue was always one of my favorite X-Men.
Yeah. Nightcrawler. Come on. Everybody loves Nightcrawler.
Meat and potatoes.
Exactly. And, you know, Gambit's not one of my favorite, but I understand his popularity and I understand his appeal. I guarantee a lot of people like him.
Uh-huh.
No, but I really thought, and then you throw in the fact that there's a flying Mesoamerican snake wrapped around a pyramid, and you guess it's a great comic.
Right. It's a really well done comic that engaged me and said and told me I will read the next issue.
I'm right there with you. Now, Jed McKay does a similar thing. There's a few characters in his lineup that I'm peripherally aware of these characters, but for the most part, again, very recognizable characters. But he does a thing where, so the X-Men are moving into this new factory, you know, hideout
in Alaska.
And the way he introduces everybody is he has the local sheriff come to visit and Beast gives them a tour. So he gets everybody up to speed because you are also on this tour as well.
Yes.
This is who I am. This is who this is. This is what we're doing here.
And this is the kinder, gentler Beast.
Yes.
Regular listeners will know I've complained about how Beast has been treated over the years. So apparently somewhere along the line, they fixed him again.
Yes.
There's even a line where he says he didn't know anything, like he wasn't there for Krakoa or whatever that thing that was happening when I wasn't paying much attention. So at some point that I missed, somehow he is okay again. And whatever the bad Beast is, you probably know this and other listeners know this. I don't. But what I appreciate is that we have the Beast that I love back.
No, it seems as if that's the case. You're not the only person who was unhappy with his characterization over the past few years. I can't speak in a lot of authority because I jump in and out of the X-Men all the time. So I kind of kept up with it, again, peripherally. I know what was happening, you know, through my sporadic reading and the fact that I listen to podcasts and people tell me things. So, but yeah, I mean, I guess, like I said, you're not the only one who didn't like his characterization. So he seems to be back to the smart beast, happy-go-lucky Avengers style.
Well, and even said, at some point, he's like, his mutant ability is not his most important skill. I love that.
Yeah, I do too. I think it's great. And it's in a similar vein in the same comic is Scott Summers, Cyclops, is taking a group out on a mission. Again, as a narrative technique to get you up to speed, he does a teaching moment. Okay, everyone, tell me what you learned. And everybody has to recite, well, because of this, we have to do this. I kind of liked how he used the first issue to get everybody up to speed through the characters in the story rather than just a big wall of text.
Or charts and graphs.
You know what? And to be fair, to your point about how you don't know all these massive characters, Hickman's graphs and little, you know, circles and arrows pointing to each character, it is helpful. I do like that. It's like reading a handbook.
Sure. Yeah. But, you know, at some point, I don't want to read a handbook.
You actually want to read a story.
If I'm reading a Jonathan Hickman comic put out by Image or Boom or something that is outside of the superhero realm, and Hickman has done fantastic stuff, just amazing stuff outside of like superhero comics, those charts and graphs make sense, and you kind of see them in the context of the narrative that he's telling that isn't just biff, bam, pow.
Yeah, it works really. A few years back, we did Black Monday Murders. And those charts and graphs are ridiculously helpful.
Yes.
In a story like that.
And they're great contextually.
Right. We love Hickman.
I do. I don't love X-Men Hickman. I did like his Fantastic Four Hickman.
I liked his Fantastic Four. I liked his Avengers. And I did like the X-Men, his X-Men, until it started ballooning out of control. And I just lost interest. But that's me. I don't know. I mean, I know that there are some people who love all that and like to get all the different issues and keep up with everything.
And that's fine. And you know, the other comic, X-Force, is fun because it's satire and parody.
Yeah, it's Mark Russell.
Because it's Mark Russell.
Exactly.
I only read there's only one issue of that. And so I read that and enjoyed, pardon?
So far, there's only the one. Yeah.
And so I enjoyed that for what that was. It wasn't the strongest of the three, as I would go on Canny and then X-Men and then X-Force in terms of the ones I enjoyed. No, it's, I feel as if I will give this another shot. If, however, things spiral as they often do, particularly with X-Men comics, into 50 titles and you have to read every one to keep up with what's happening, even Saint Gale might not be enough.
I know. It's going to be X-Men Gold, X-Men Red, X-Men Purple, X-Men Magenta.
X-Force, X-Files, X-Fantastic, X-Static, X-Complete, X...
Ecstasy.
Ecstasy.
So, but in...
Triple X... Yes. It's the Max. They're going to bring back Max for Triple X X-Men.
Surely there's got to be one of those, right? I'm not Googling it, but I'm sure there is one. By the way, in X-Factor, that's the one that had a few people I was not familiar with.
Yeah.
It's on the cast line. One of the characters is Cameo, which only shows up occasionally, I guess. Either that or his power is the ability to get people to pay him to do videos for them.
Well, I mean, I think with X-Force, it's going to be one of those, what's the comic where it's not Suicide Squad, it's, although Suicide Squad had a little bit of this, there was a comic where, like, so X-Force is set up where, like, characters are just going to die.
Right.
Right. They're just going to keep introducing new, it's just going to be a gristmill.
To sum this all up, I do like just a comic book run to every once in a while, pair it back and start, not necessarily start fresh. It's not like they're jettisoning all the previous continuity.
Mm-hmm.
I do what I'm just real quick. I hate canon. Like if something's canon and it has to be, I hate that.
Right.
Continuity is fine. That's a completely different thing. But nothing is set in stone, and storytellers are free to do whatever story they want without being beholden to canon. So fanboys, stop with the canon thing. Just let storytellers tell stories.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah. I'm with you on it.
But I like it when it just gets pared back a little bit, go back to basics, and then start. It allows new people to jump in and you can start telling stories again.
Right. Fresh. And this is something we've addressed a 100 times or more, is comics right now, like especially in the big two, are so geared towards people of a certain age. And the inaccessibility of things like the X-Men doesn't bring in new readers. And at some point, if you're not bringing in new readers, and the world has changed, you know, people aren't buying floppies, you know, they're reading on their tablets, they're reading anime, if they're reading comics at all. If you can't allow for somebody to enter your world, then your audience eventually will literally die.
Right. Plus the fact that it's like, I was just, it stifles creativity. As far as I'm concerned, don't write for me. You know, I'm the old fuddy-duddy guy. You know, if you write stories that appeal to me or geared towards me, they're going to be boring and it's just going to be rehash of old stuff. Yeah. And that's not fun. Write for the new generation and either I can run alongside or get left behind. And that's fine.
And if we get left behind, you know what? We have 100 years of comics.
Yes, I have decades worth of comics.
If new stuff isn't appealing to us.
Exactly. Case in point, there's a comic that was written a long time ago in my era that I had never read before. And it was called Alpha Flight. Let's take a break and come back and talk about it.
Okay, sounds good.
And we're back. Brian, this week, you have made the recommendations, so it is your turn to tell us about it.
Yes, well, and it's been, what, 8 months since I did one of these, so hopefully I remember how to do this.
Yeah, it's muscle memory. You're good.
Oh, Canada. The following is crib from Wikipedia. Canada is a country in North America. Its 10 provinces and 3 territories extend from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean and northward into the Arctic Ocean, making it the world's second largest country by total area with the world's longest coastline. Interesting. Its border with the United States is the world's longest international land border. The country is characterized by a wide range of both meteorologic and geological regions. It is a sparsely inhabited country of just over 41 million people, the vast majority residing south of the 55th parallel in urban areas. Neat, eh? So Canada is big, really big. It also has a reputation for being nice, or at least much more polite than its rather boisterous and loud neighbor down along their southern border. But even a country with Canada's reputation can still produce a decent amount of criming and ne'er-do-well rapscallions, including short, ill-tempered men with claws. And, as great as the RCMP are, it stands to reason the country could use its own team of superheroes to help with the more nefarious evildoers that lurk within its mighty mass. Hence, Alpha Flight, who, unlike their compatriots in the US, have to cover huge tracts of land rather than just one city. Created by John Byrne for Uncanny X-Men numbers 120 through 121, Alpha Flight served as a foil for insert mutant team and as connecting device between Wolverine and Canada's Department H, which was headed by James McDonald Hudson, aka Vindicator, and later Guardian. The team proved popular and were launched as an ongoing series in 1983, with Byrne, John Byrne, handling writing and art chores. It is said Byrne was unhappy with the assignment, as he felt he didn't have much to add to the characters. He would be proven wrong, particularly in one very specific case. Structurally, the first 8 issues, which we are covering today, are interesting. The first issue is the generic Let's Get the Band Together story, where we are introduced individually to Vindicator, aka Guardian, Shaman, Northstar, Aurora, Puck, Marina, Sasquatch, and Snowbird. Having had the team disbanded by the government, each hero responds individually to an emergency. As each hero tries their hand battling the menace solo, it is only when they work together as a team that they succeed. All in all, a pretty standard intro. But it does provide a modicum of character insight. The next three issues follow suit, with the team taking on a rather forgettable villain, but again, allowing us to see these folks work together as a team. Since they had been a team before, it should be assumed that this was standard, but since, outside of cameos, we the readers hadn't seen this. It does fall on Byrne to establish this. The next four issues show an interesting pivot. Rather than continue with the team concept so early on, Byrne opts to feature individuals in solo stories. A strange choice, frankly, but it kind of works, particularly in issue 7 starring Northstar and Aurora. In many ways, a landmark issue in comics history, it does something that mainstream comics had avoided and continued to avoid going forward for many years. And surprisingly, knowing Byrne's personal views, it is done with a sense of respect, subtlety, and a lack of stereotype that would not be the norm for decades to come. Alpha Flight is not a great comic book by any stretch of the imagination. It is very much an early 80s Marvel comic and all that that entails. But it also has some strong revolutionary concepts, even outside issue 7. Having a team based outside of New York and representing another country is great, but having that team also reflect respectfully cultures and indigenous issues outside of the norm of US perspective makes Alpha Flight a capstone on the changing nature of mainstream superhero comics. So, Paul, I recommended this. You read it. You had never read it before. Thoughts, feelings?
Canada, America's hat. As you mentioned, I never read this before. All of these characters and the concept of Alpha Flight, of course, I knew of. And they would always make cameos in other other stories.
And the Marvel Comics guy, you ran into them a lot.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But I never sat down and read their series. And it's 80s comics by the numbers.
Yes.
But it's interesting and it's different in the way that, it's new, different characters. And it's knowing some of the backstory and knowing that John Byrne basically was handed this and said, here's a bunch of characters. We don't have backstory or anything. We have some names and costumes. Go for it. And it was up to him to just sort of flesh this out.
Right.
In the best way he could. And he did an admirable job, I must say. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of times where it's kind of borderline like Shaman. I mean, it's done respectfully, but at the same time, he is kind of leaning on some of the standard cliches, trying to break out of them.
Sure.
But
well, comics are cliches.
Yeah. But he's trying. I'll give John Byrne. I will give John Byrne full credit. You tried real hard.
I think that him growing up in Canada helps with some of this. And you're right. I mean, all of these characters are stereotypes in some ways. Guardian is Canada's Captain America. They even say that numerous times.
And Guardian actually references the fact that he's proud of the fact that he's Canada's Captain America.
Right.
So, and, you know, Marina is Namor to the point where they go running off together.
Yes.
At one point. And Aurora and Northstar are, you know, the Wonder Twins, I guess. I don't know what they are.
they are the Wonder Twins.
Yes.
Although I think, at least for our purposes today, they are the most interesting characters.
Oh, absolutely. For sure they are.
You know, Sasquatch and Puck are like the two different sides of Wolverine.
Right. I think Puck's mutant power is the fact that he can grow immense amounts of hair on a very small form. Sasquatch actually looks at Puck and goes, dude, you're a little hairy. No. I mean, we'll get into all the individual characters in a minute here. But by the way, just for listeners, Brian and I are aware of John Byrne's problematic nature these days, which we addressed on a previous issue. So go back and listen to our She-Hulk issue where we talk about John Byrne and our feelings on him. So we're not going to get into his personal issues.
Though it'd be
personal controversies, I should say.
Right. Although some of it will be semi-relevant when we get to a later issue in that his approach was out of character for what we know about John Byrne.
Absolutely.
That's coming up. Yes. Most readers here are going to know where we're headed.
Exactly.
Most listeners are going to know where we're headed here.
Fix your direction to the North Star and you will know where we're going. But yeah, overall, I enjoyed this. I read it.
83 Marvel comic book.
Right. I read this with nostalgia goggles and it was fun. We can get into the actual critique of it in a moment. But if you're just looking for a, you know, goofy 80s comic, this literally fits, by the numbers, I guess. I've said that already. But it's a standard comic with a seminal creator trying to do something interesting with
characters he doesn't like.
Exactly.
So, but he stayed on for like 28 issues.
I know. And then Alpha Flight, how long did this run? It ran for a while.
It ran into the 90s, this volume. And then, of course, there's been numerous. I think Alpha Flight is important. It's an important team because beyond these 8 issues, and I don't want to get, because our focus generally should just be on the issues we're reading, not. But we do have leeway for some history or whatever. A lot of these characters go through some pretty important and interesting story arcs, both within the main title and as part of the Marvel Universe. Some of these characters are very much, some of them have fallen by the wayside, but a lot of these characters are very much still within the Marvel world, whether they're featured prominently or not. You know, I mean, they have become canon. We spoke about canon earlier. Some of these characters have become canonized. Well, the other thing, one of the things we find out, like in the first issue, which is, again, there's not a lot to say about the first issue, except that we understand, we find it really is the let's get the band back together type of thing. I mean, it follows very generic plot lines, but we are reminded that James McDonald Hudson, Guardian or Vindicator, whichever he is, the Vindicator for this issue and then Guardian going forward, was the creator of Department H. And any X-Men fan are going to know exactly what Department H is. James McDonald, Hudson McDonald, or James McDonald Hudson, whichever it is, gave us Wolverine.
Yes. And Wolverine, they keep mentioning Wolverine. It's every once in a while, a character has to go, boy, I miss Wolverine. Sure wish Wolverine was here.
I love the fact that, you know, and of course, we all know Wolverine is Canadian, but the members of this team are immediately linked to Marvel history is important.
Yeah. Absolutely. And to get to your point from before the break about a team that gets started and then has a bunch of characters die, the original iteration of Alpha Flight, which was an antagonist to the X-Men, a bunch of those characters either were killed outright or were forced into retirement to get this new team up and running. So, it's very interesting.
Well, and I like the fact that it's also, so the name Alpha Flight is because there's Alpha Flight, Beta Flight, and Gamma Flight. And then there's some other flights that come later in their history, Omega and what have you. But the fact that it's like the X-Men, it's a training ground for Canadian superheroes.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, you have the majors.
And because it's Canada, it's government sponsored.
Right. No, but you have the majors, it's Alpha Flight, and then you have the minors in AAA. I think it's a good system.
And there's a humorous bit where they're like thinking about changing the name because it's like, well, it doesn't make sense if there's, because the government is cut off funding. So a plot point here, we're actually getting to a plot point. They basically disbanded the team. And this is why in this first issue, we see that getting the band back together sort of concept is that they're all showing up individually because they're not part of the team anymore. And by the end of the first issue, after they fight the big bad Tundra, they all gather back at somebody's home and, you know, chat and have beverages and whatever and decide they want to keep going. And they're like, well, we shouldn't call ourselves Alpha Flight because there is no Beta or Gamma Flight anymore. And then they decide, well, that's our name, so we're just going to go with it.
Yeah, I don't know. I like the fact that they just kind of said, it's still a cool name. Let's just go with that. Yeah, and I love the fact that it's a revolving group of Canada-based villains. Tundra. I don't know. It's fun.
But I think that's also interesting because it pays homage to, like, these are very Canadian villains. And like, the two kind of big ones that we, you know, we have twice monsters or beasts of myth that rise up from the ground. Important that they both come from the native soil.
comes from the land itself. Yeah.
From the land itself. And obviously there's a hint that something bigger is going on that happens beyond the 8 issues we're reading, but they are so uniquely Canadian and so steeped in the lore, the folklore of Canada is really interesting. How were you able to do that in the very American, superheroes only live in New York, things only happen in New York, bad guys only come to New York, and then you have a team that could give a shit about New York, and the villains could give a shit about New York. I apologize for the language. And it's about the culture of a different country.
Yeah. And they go to, and they go to different cities. I mean, they're in Montreal, they're in Ottawa, mm-hmm. they're in Vancouver. They're hitting all the big, cities. And I just, the fact that they're in a different country. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would like to see this more in comics of having, you know, you kind of, I mean, you sort of got Justice League International, you know, you got around the world.
But, never forget Justice League Detroit.
Well, you had Midwest Avengers.
West Coast Avengers, which was the other option for our topic today.
Yes. Behind the scenes, I was given a list of options and I chose Alpha Flight. That was my first choice. That was my alpha choice. Anyway, it's interesting to have a different perspective. Like, as you know, to get to your point about everything being set in New York, occasionally a trip down to DC just for funsies.
Right.
It's different and it's I like interest. I like interesting.
And while Byrne does play into some stereotypes like with Shaman and other things, but with Snowbird, there's no stereotypes there. That is a unique creation.
Yeah. Snowbird is just a really, I mean, if North Star weren't in this comic, I think Snowbird would be the most interesting character.
Right. Because she is, so not to give anything away, we find out throughout these 8 issues, Snowbird is the product of an exchanging of seed.
Yes.
As it says in the comic, between some random dude who turns out to be more important than we thought and a female god. And the whole point was that this melding of these two would create an offspring that would save the world. Not a completely original idea by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I mean, in comics in 1983, there's some adult stuff going on here.
I had to reread that battle. It's like, I need your seed. Wait, is she saying what I think she's, yeah, she's saying that.
She's saying what she, yeah, you know.
Even the character was just like, say again? But he was chosen for his ability to put a headband on.
Well,
that's some serious father potential right there.
Yeah. I mean, this is we're skipping ahead, but the origin is it's an archaeologist who finds a headband at a dig, puts the headband on. Everybody thinks this is just a generic artifact. And he puts the headband on because he's obsessed with it, goes on a walkabout. I realize we're on the wrong continent, but a walkabout nevertheless, encounters these gods. So they bow, chicka, bow, bow, a little bit. And then he passes out for 10 years.
Because that was a good session.
And then when he awakens, he's lost his mind. Nobody, you know, everything has changed. So he continues on his walkabout. And we find out by issue 8 that he is the one that back in issue 1 is responsible for creating Tundra, who is the big bad of issue 1 that Alpha Flight fights. Snowbird is also the one who creates the big bad that brings Alpha Flight together.
Which is a nice little bookend for this collection.
It's almost like Byrne was thinking ahead.
Almost. Planning? My God.
But that is an interesting narrative thing to have happen, again, in a comic book that is not overly consequential.
And this, I mean, and Byrne was still fairly young and fairly early on in his career. And you could see him just sort of working through some of the themes that he would later, you know, work out in some of his more mature comics, I guess. As in been around for a while.
His craft continued to be honed. But he had been writing Fantastic Four and X-Men before, Uncanny X-Men before this. This was his first rodeo.
Oh, no. That's not what I'm saying. It was just like, it's still, he's in his early on career where he's still just throwing ideas out there. He's got that young man's enthusiasm.
Yeah, it's before he became more difficult.
There you go.
But like, so Snowbird is the product of gods and man.
Of gods and men.
And of course, her character arc becomes very interesting later. So for the sort of generic Guardian is Captain America, and other characters are just...
Sasquatch is the Hulk.
Sasquatch is the Hulk, right? And Puck is either Beast or Wolverine, whichever you prefer.
Yeah, he's more of a beast, I guess. Acrobatic, hairy guy.
Yeah.
And he's sad, so he could be blue as well.
Yes. But he's the comic relief as well, because, yes, let's make the short guy the comic relief.
You would never see that in, say, like a major Lord of the Rings trilogy or anything like that.
I mean, these are all, like, there are interesting things going on here in the midst of some very basic superhero plotting.
And then, of course, when we get to both Aurora and Northstar, there are some definitely interesting things going on with those two. Yeah.
And I guess to address so the first issue we've already kind of talked about, and I think we see some hints, and again, Northstar and Aurora are the ones, but before we get to that, the next three issues are kind of dull.
Well, I mean, you're talking about like the solo.
No, the next three issues are the Marina.
Oh, that's right. It's the Marina arc. Abduction arc.
Right. And it went on probably two issues longer than it should have. I get what he was doing, because I think he's trying to show the team acting as a team.
Well,
relearning, because they had been a team before.
But exactly.
He had to show us. He's showing, not telling.
Yeah.
So which
he's
is
assuming
good.
We've never. Yeah. He's assuming we've never seen this team before. So, but it is, you know, one person tries to do something which they can't quite do it unless their team member comes in and helps out with their particular power.
The big bad is the master. He's Vandal Savage.
Or he wants so badly to be Vandal Savage.
He wants so badly to be Vandal Savage, but he's at the wrong company. so he's a Neanderthal. He's
proto-human or something like that.
But, you know, there's aliens, and they come and they torture a human, and the human overcomes that and takes over whatever the aliens are doing. But the aliens are like planting eggs, because it's all very convoluted. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It's just aliens trying to take over a planet. But the aliens failed because the ship didn't work.
And I know Marina comes back, but it seemed to me as if Byrne was trying desperately to get Marina off the table, because yeah. she has water-based powers in a huge landlocked area. Huge tracts of land. Yes. So they're inland most of this comic, and unless they're near a river, Marina's not really helping.
No. I mean, she was instrumental in the first issue.
Yes, but still, she was like miles away.
Yeah.
She has to find a really convoluted way to get the water to the battle section.
It's so at the end of the day, we discover Marina's origin is that she's an alien who was in an egg that was prematurely discharged. Because of the damage to the spaceship that was landing. The spaceship was damaged and so couldn't control itself, so it discharged its egg early.
It's a metaphor.
And then she was discovered by a kindly couple. Does this sound familiar?
Yeah,
a kindly couple.
In a rural setting.
Right.
Yeah.
Who raised her until she discovered her powers.
Yeah, and there's... Okay. So Byrne, a couple of times, I got to say this, there's a couple of times in this comic when Byrne does some questionable things. Like, so at one point, Marina leaves, goes off with Namor and right. has adventures underwater, under the sea. So she has a brother, an adopted brother.
Uh-huh.
And they say, well, he has more than just fraternal feelings towards her. It's like, uh-huh. No, dude, that's creepy, man. Don't. Yep. And then the other thing... where Guardian's girlfriend, is 17 years old. Why? Just make her 18. Or make her 20.
The question is, why did they go there?
Yes.
And what's interesting is they went there, but then they tried to like justify it, right? It's so this is in a later, or actually, no, this is one of the earlier issues where, yeah. So it's Heather McNeil who ends up becoming Guardian or James McDonald's wife.
Right.
And she has an interesting, because she also was the neighbor of Shaman before he was Shaman. His name is Michael Too Young.
Too Young Man.
That's the most glaring. Why is his name Michael Too Young Man?
Well, maybe he's Jewish and it's Too Young Man.
Well, his uncle is Henny.
Henny Too Young Man.
But, you know, she's also like the babysitter for Michael Too Young Man's daughter. So she has a history here. But to get to your point, first of all, what is a 17-year-old doing as whatever she was at Department H?
Yeah, she seems some kind of executive secretary or something like that.
No 17-year-old would be granted access to that level of security.
I mean, yeah, there's no point for her.
Then she shows up. So it is interesting because Guardian, James McDonald, he is not showing interest in her.
No.
Luckily, phew, right? Until she just shows up at his house with groceries.
Yeah.
And says, we should get married.
Yeah. I mean, he says, how old are you? 17. Well, she is kind of cute. Like, what?
He says he could be arrested for her being in his apartment. Which is great. Okay, there's your moral center. Yes, you are correct, sir. You are absolutely correct. But then he doesn't kick her out.
And then he says, when are you going to be 18? Oh, in a few months. Okay, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah.
It's so weird. John, just make her in college. If you want to have a younger woman.
Why not make her 19? Or make her an age in which she could have the level of governmental security or clearance.
Yeah. Put her
in a secure facility making weapons.
Make her university age and studying something that makes her relevant to be in Department H. And then later on, after they do get married, it's her salary that allows him to go off and gallivant around being Guardian.
Yes.
Yeah, because he says that. He's like, oh, thank God she's making the money. Anymore. Yeah.
Now, eventually, we find out they do get some government money and whatever, but...
Alpha Flight's on the dole.
It's so weird. Yeah, it's so weird. I think, this happens... Like, through these issues, we get the origin of Alpha Flight, and none of them are particularly compelling enough to talk about, unless, Paul, you have...
No, I mean, there's a couple of things.
We are getting a North Star, folks. We are getting a North Star.
That's the finale. No, I mean, we get the origin of Snowbird, which is, it is compelling, sort of, the origin of Marina. Guardian is basically Iron Man, sort of.
Right, because it's a mech suit. He's creating cybernetics inside his suit, which is, yeah.
Yeah, so, but he ends up stealing the suit and destroying the plan so that the military can't use it as a weapon. But then he leaves it in a field and walks away.
But he took the cybernetic helmet.
Right.
Which controlled it. I have a feeling that might come back.
You think? I don't want anyone to get this suit, so I'm just going to leave it here out in the open for anyone to grab. And then you had the Puck story.
Right. So once we get past this bit with the aliens and the Master, and we have special guest star Sue Reed and Namor somewhere.
I say Namor. You can say Namor. Let's call the whole thing off.
Oh, Namor. Boy, that's erasure references probably aren't going to fly too much until we get to North Star, at least. But so we get through these first four issues, which are a lot of table setting. And then we get a couple more issues of table setting.
Well, we got to talk about the snowbird in the room. She has her own issue.
Yes.
Which is great. That's fine. She has her own issue. You get a little bit of her story. Then she fights.
I have a lot to say about this issue, and I think you're heading there.
She tries to save. So she tries to fight someone who causes a blizzard, and we get, what is it? 6 pages of blank white.
I wrote that down. It's 5 pages of nothing but dialogue.
In blank white panels. Panel, panel, panel of white, white, white. Nothing in there except for dialogue. And
5 pages.
It's either
somebody who's overloaded with work.
Yeah, it's either incredibly experimental or the laziest thing I've ever fucking seen.
I think it's the laziest fucking thing we've ever seen.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what John Byrne's workload was at that time, because I believe he was writing Fantastic Four at the time.
Yes, he was.
And historians can correct me if I'm wrong, but this isn't the only thing he was doing. And he was penciling. He wasn't just penciling. He was inking these issues as well. So I get it. And there have been humorous bits by writers later on who, and there's one specific example, and I'm forgetting it, where the writer actually says, is it Steve Gerber? It might be Steve Gerber. I don't know. But where they actually did panels with nothing, they literally were saying, I'm too busy to draw this.
Was that Ambush Bug?
Oh, yes. Ambush Bug did that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not the only ones, but yeah.
Oh,
and
so boy. You
have this entire fight scene that is done in letterbox with Biff Bam Pals.
Right. With a couple of things like, now I'm going to use this power and turn into a bear. Well, that would have been nice to see.
I stopped reading. I didn't read all that. Even for my homework today, I didn't read it. I was like, I flipped ahead and then Snowbird wins. Yeah. Okay. Well,
I did read it and I was just like, surely he's going to justify this in some way. And
it's actually 5.5 pages.
Well, because at the bottom, he actually takes the time to freaking draw a goddamn panel. And it has Snowbird saying, what you just witnessed was one of the clashes of the gods. It has a character say, actually, we didn't see a thing. Yeah. You even acknowledge the fact that there's nothing there. But when you read these dialogue balloons, it's all Snowbird describing what she's doing.
Yeah.
Changing into this character or changing into this animal and changing into that animal. And then there's a blast coming from somewhere. It's like, it would have been great to see that, Mr. Byrne.
Yeah. But he literally just whited out an entire battle sequence.
Yeah.
Rather than draw it.
Well, I thought surely it's just one page and it's like, okay, that's interesting. You know, doing a whiteout. And then you turn the page and it's another. And then another page of nothing. And then another page of nothing. Holy cow. And by the way, I'm going to address the foul language in the room. Since we've been back, we've been cursing a lot. And I think this is the new normal now. I think it's fine. So anyway, if anyone's offended by our language, we'll try to keep it to a minimum. But sometimes the shit's got to hit the fan occasionally.
Yeah, but it's such an intriguing character. And for this, I am guessing that Byrne was overloaded and
this was
a solution. And he was attempted to do it as a clever,
with air quotes around it, clever
solution to it. And it's disappointing because issue 3 has one of my favorite covers of all time with its use of negative space. Aurora being trapped by the steel or the metal bars or whatever.
Right.
And it's a great cover. It's conceptually so good because of how it's used. It's like, so Byrne is capable.
Oh, absolutely. And all right, I'm going to say something that's going to surprise you because it's going to be 2 weeks in a row. Reminds me a lot of Frank Miller. With the way
Frank Miller definitely used, especially as he moved on into like Sin City, which is all about negative space and the use of black and white.
That's 2 weeks in a row I praised Frank Miller. So. I feel dirty. I need to take a shower.
Yeah, I was going to say it. Be okay. But it's an interesting issue. The issue before it with Puck is interesting only in that it gives sort of character to Puck. So Puck is reading Shakespeare because, of course, a character named Puck reads Shakespeare. It's a little on the nose, but, it's a murder mystery, or it's a mystery, and Puck solves a mystery because Puck doesn't have any powers. He's not a mutant. He has no powers. He literally just...
Yeah. I later on down the road, not John Byrne, but whoever took over after that would give him, like, he's got a demon inside of him or something like that.
Yeah.
So, but at this point, Byrne wanted him to just be a guy who's stronger than your average human, but acrobatic kind of thing.
But Guardian doesn't have any powers either. Like you said, he's Iron Man. He's
right.
Has a suit.
And I do like, Puck does have an appropriate name for a Canadian.
Yeah.
He's a Puck. His partner, his girlfriend, Annette.
boy. But all of this leads to issue 7. So issue 7. when I, in 1983, this could have been 1984 by this point. I don't remember when the individual issues dropped, but the series started in 1983. So it's either 83 or 84. I was either 11 or 12 years old. I picked up Alpha Flight. I was fully invested in comics. I went to the local Lawson's, which anybody in Ohio, like I didn't know about comic book stores quite yet, or we didn't have one around. So Lawson's was like the local 7-Eleven or what have you. And you went to the comic rack and
the spinner.
At Lawson's, it wasn't on a spinner, though. It, like the local grocery store had a spinner, but Lawson's, it was just in the magazine rack.
And fancy.
Yeah. Well, not really, because they just threw them in there and you just had to figure stuff out. That's where I got all my G.I. Joes early on, too. And all my other comics were from Lawson's.
This episode brought to you by Lawson's.
So I was 11 or 12, and I was interested in Alpha Flight, either because I was reading X-Men at the time, amongst many other comics when they were cheap. I remember picking up Alpha Flight, and I was like, oh, I want to read this, because, you know, used to have the soap, the hype boxes and all of that stuff. So you knew what comics were coming, even if you were 10 or 11 and didn't have a comic book store or whatever. Right. Marvel and DC made sure you knew what comics were coming. I picked it up, and the one thing I remember, and this could be the Mandela effect, I remember the paper being different. And I don't know if this is when Marvel switched its paper. I don't know. This is just a memory I have.
I mean, it was like went to a more glossy kind of paper?
No, it was just a different kind of paper. And again, this is almost 40 years ago. Again, it's a memory that could be false. And I lived in rural Ohio with religious parents or religious mom, and not a whole lot of understanding of the real world. Subtleties were not a thing at that age and where I was. I read a lot. I was just an avid reader, not just comics, but like fantasy novels and other books. And I was starting to read proper novels at that point. I mean, I was and remain a huge reader. So at some point, the light bulb was going to come on for me with subtext or with a deeper reading of things. But I wasn't quite there yet. I had no idea. I understood that X-Men might be representing something different than what I was just thinking it was, but I wasn't able to put that together. Okay. So what I can tell you is when I read issue 7 the first time, no stinking clue. I have a feeling that other people at 11 or 12 with different experiences in their lives and different feelings about things in their lives might have read issue 7 and caught it and maybe saw something, however small, that they saw themselves in.
There are some stories online where people say that, yeah, they did read this and they did see themselves reflected in this. I can't speak to that because I read it 2 weeks ago. So so I did understand the subject.
You caught it immediately. But you also know the history of North Star, even outside of Alpha Flight, because North Star is featured prominently
in
many, many comics going forward.
Right. And in 2012, there was a very famous wedding and uproar over this. It's interesting to know. And then to do, you know, I, of course, did a little bit of cursory research. I can't say I did a deep dive into this, but I did know that John Byrne himself says this was his intention. And he would have, and he had every intention of going further and being more explicit in his depiction. I mean, perhaps we should just say North Star's gay.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, let's just get that out of the oven.
Everybody listening to this are already going to have known this before we even started.
There could be someone just stumbled in and has no idea. So,
right.
North Star is gay, first openly gay character in Marvel. I don't think in comics, but in Marvel.
Not in comics, but certainly in mainstream comics. I guess I should clarify that there have been references to gay characters in the past in Marvel and DC.
There have been queer coded.
Done in, but some of them coded, some of them done in a not fantastic overtly stereotypical fashion. Like indie comics have many indie comics and many other things have addressed this, but this is 1982, 83, 84. What is it? And we'll get to this. And I also want to talk about Aurora because Aurora is important too. And the fact that they're twins and both are dealing with
hidden aspects. Yeah. Hidden aspects of their.
This is really, we should have led with this. Maybe this whole conversation should have been this issue because I feel like we took a long time getting here and we've lost potentially some focus. But, John Byrne, like there's a quote, and I'm not going to get it exactly right, but when do we ever? But he says, you know, hey, there are gay people in the world, and they should, you know, it's like they are part of everyday life. And so his argument there was, why not include one of them in the comics? Now, what he did was he made a choice not to include the character in a stereotypical way.
Right.
And this is what surprises me about John Byrne because of some other comments he's made. It is a really respectful reading.
Yes.
And I can't speak to others whose experiences in life are different, but like queer coding just didn't exist.
In fact, so this is what I was going to get at is Byrne wanted to go further and be more explicit in his depiction of North Star's sexuality, but couldn't because the editor-in-chief was Jim Shooter at this point, who mandated that there be no homosexuality in Marvel Comics.
Right.
That was
some of that's comics code.
Well, yeah, but
actually a lot of that is comics code.
At the same time, Shooter.
Right, comics
Shooter.
Code thing about perversion and what comics code meant by perversion was specifically homosexuality.
Right, right. But let's not let Shooter off the hook here.
No, I'm not.
Anyway, yeah. So I mean, historically, you have John Byrne versus Jim Shooter, the titans of crankiness, which is interesting historical fact in and of itself. But yeah, so John Byrne had to tiptoe around this quite a bit. But for what he did, I mean, it's reading it now with 2024 eyes, it's obvious what he's trying to do. And it's everything you just said. He's being very respectful. And he could have gone so, you know, he could have made
Raymond Belmond.
Yeah, he could have made him much more stereotypical.
But not stereotypical at all. Neither is North Star.
Neither is North Star.
In some cases, the stereotype is fine, not for us to put the stereotype on, but, you know, the world is full of people and some of them represent in certain ways, some of them, and I don't...
I guess what I mean, like, for the time,
right,
to be stereotypical would have been cruel.
Yeah.
It could have been a parody and yeah, no. He was very... Yeah, exactly. So he was being respectful, as we said. So
yeah. So North Star and Aurora, they go for a walk in a certain part of the city. And Aurora comments on, I didn't know that you knew about this type of area. Or she was surprised they were in this particular area. And I'm going to do some quotes here because I think some of this stuff is important. North Star responds with, I have... ... depth you do not suspect, sister. An old friend lives on this street. What is interesting, I want to talk about the lettering, because the lettering here is important too. Friend is in bold. This isn't the first time lettering is coded.
Yes, you're supposed to read that in a certain way. I have an right. old friend.
Right. When the letter does bold, it's intended to be read with emphasis. We all know this. We read comics. And then he says, perhaps I have spoken of him, ellipses, Raymond Belmond. He, ellipses, he helped me through some difficult times. There's another quote I'm going to get to. And then there's a passage that I want to read when we get to it. Again, at 12 years old.
I think there would be a lot of adults who read this, including Jim Shooter, who didn't know,
right.
who just let it go by because, yeah, he's talking about a friend in an upscale neighborhood. It's all fine. Volumes are spoken with the ellipses.
Yeah, the ellipses are, I know ellipses are out of favor these days. I still love ellipses. I still use them because it mimics pauses. But
you just did it right there.
Yes, I had ellipses. I'm getting it treated. I have a medication for that.
Yes, a little bit of penicillin clears up ellipses.
But the focus of the story is that North Star and Aurora are meeting an old friend. Aurora, so the plot of this is kind of, Aurora gets her purse snatched, or she's not Aurora, she is, what's her
name? Well, we should get into, yes, so.
We need to get into Aurora as well, because that is another intriguing aspect.
So Aurora has a split personality, which we would classify differently.
Dissociative identity disorder.
Exactly.
It wasn't called that at the time, but we know that now.
So she has one personality, Jean-Marie. No, Jean-Marie, who is demure and...
Conservative.
Doesn't want anything to do with superheroing.
I don't mean politically, I mean just...
Lowercase c.
Lowercase c, who despises Aurora, and Aurora is the... more wild, outgoing superhero.
Free spirit, willing to do anything. And
so it is interesting that we are presented with twins. It's the fact that they're twins, and they both have what we would say are two separate personalities each.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say hidden aspects of their lives. Right. Yeah.
One medical or psychological, and the other personal. But twins, I mean, this is, I'm sorry, Paul, this is deconstructionist stuff right here.
That's all good. Yeah.
It's twins. So that's two who split into two each. I mean, I don't know if John Byrne intended this. I don't know if I want to give him intellectual credit for this, which is why I'm going deconstructionist, because it's the onset, it's the signifiers that may be unintentional, but twins who twin.
And I think it's fair to give John Byrne credit for this. I mean, it's clever writing, and he for all of John Byrne's faults, he is a clever writer. I'll give him credit for that.
Yeah, but it's fascinating. It's one thing to have two separate characters, but the fact that they're twins and going through this and both, I mean, Aurora and Northstar are such interesting characters.
Yeah,
and I didn't understand that at my age.
Right. To contrast them, and again, I'm gonna project forward a little bit of what I know of the characters. So you have Aurora, who eventually does become whole. You know, she has two aspects of her personality. She will eventually combine them to become whole. Yeah. But then you also have Northstar, who has his you know, public persona as Northstar, as the great handsome ski champion.
Yeah.
And then he has his romantic life. His other side.
Or his real life.
His real life, who he really is.
His real person.
And eventually that he will come out and he will become whole. And the two characters, the twins, will mimic each other.
Yeah.
It's very clever. It's we're just seeing the beginnings of this right here. But all credit to Byrne for initializing this.
The story is secondary. It involves a whole lot of folderol about a bad guy named Deadly Ernest, who can kill with a touch of his hand. And
Deadly Ernest.
Yeah, I mean, I got to be honest, it's kind of a great name.
Well, then there's also the really intelligent guy, Alec, who's smart Alec.
Right. There's this whole bit about, it's a really generic plot about some guy trying to like take over areas of the city because he's a mafia style guy. His origin we get, but it's kind of dumb. Who cares? It's a forgettable villain. We are introduced to Nemesis, which is interesting. But what the major thing that happens in here is that Raymond is killed by Deadly Ernest because he won't sell his cafe to him. And this leads to, well, before this even happens, I have another quote. I'm sorry, I have a lot of quotes here because I think that this is really important stuff that's going on in here. Before this happens, when Northstar introduces Aurora to Raymond then introduces his daughter. And Raymond and Northstar says, Raymond, this is your Ellipses daughter, again, with emphasis.
Yeah.
But how? I mean, Ellipses, you never told me of a daughter. Northstar is immediately confused. Like, it's the, but how?
Right.
And then, if you'll indulge me, I'm going to read three. Raymond is killed by Deadly Ernest. And this is Northstar's response. And visually, it's also incredible. As John Byrne, it's three panels. And John Byrne shows North Star standing back over Raymond and his daughter. His daughter is holding Raymond, and North Star is standing over them. The next panel moves in closer. North Star looks angry, and he has his fists clenched. And then the last panel is North Star close up to his face with a tear. And this is the dialogue. And I'm sorry, I'm going to read it. "I think he's dead." The words seem to reverberate along the suddenly silent street. Jean-Paul Beaubier feels a great black emptiness open in his heart. A gaping moth threatens to swallow whole his world. Until North Star found Aurora, Raymond Belmond had been the most important person in his life. More than a father, much more than a friend, he had found Jean-Paul scarcely more than a boy, alone and frightened. Frightened of what he thought he was and what he feared he might become. And Raymond had led him out of that dark fear into the bright, clear light of self-acceptance, teaching him not to fear his mutant powers or any other thing. Now, with the speaking of four short, sharp words, an iron door has closed upon a chapter of his life, and Jean-Paul Beaubier is alone again. I don't know how that could be much more explicit.
Right. Yeah.
That is almost, I would never say this about John Byrne generally, that is touching and that is heartbreaking when you understand the context.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if Raymond was a lover. Part of me doesn't think he was.
I read it as that.
Explicitly said.
I'll give credit to Byrne because he writes that in such a way that you can, from an editorial standpoint, you could let that go by because he could just be talking about his superpowers, his mutant powers.
And that's what was meant for Jim Shooter to read.
Exactly. But it's the qualifiers in there, much more than a friend, not more than a friend, much more than a friend or anything else. Not to be afraid of his mutant power or anything else. I mean, Byrne was definitely skirting around what he could get away with.
To be people reading that, not me at that time. There had to be people reading that who saw themselves in this, who understood what was being said and saw in mainstream comics themselves.
Which is how it should be, you know. The fact that Byrne had to couch the language and hide it.
It's not subtle now in our contemporary reading.
It sure was back then, yeah.
It's weird to me. I love John Byrne. I do. I love a lot of his writing. I hate a lot of his writing. I love a lot of his writing. He's a complex character.
Yeah.
He's a complex character. He's a real human being. His character
he's
is
a
complex.
Person.
He's a person. He's a human person. And like when we read She-Hulk, that's hilarious, right? It was a lot of fun.
And I think I said this on the She-Hulk, that, you know, his run of Fantastic Four is amazing.
Yeah.
It's great. It's fantastic, you could say.
It's fantastic. He's done so much good stuff along with so much bad stuff. And I think he deserves to be elevated into the pantheon of important creators.
Oh,
as
absolutely.
Much as I've read, and maybe someone will present something to me better, but to me, rereading this and rediscovering this, I knew, like when I haven't read this since 1980, whatever. So I was reading this with kind of new eyes as well as you. And maybe I need to read more John Byrne, but there are no three panels in John Byrne's career that I value more highly than these three.
Having read it,
other people will strongly disagree and they'll point out, you know, oh, what about this scene and blah, blah, blah. But these three panels are some of the bravest comic writing I've ever seen.
I would agree with you. Now, I, again, read this for the first time 2 weeks ago, and I was on the lookout for this. So would this have gone over my head? Yes, it would have gone over my head. But knowing what to look for and knowing what he was attempting to do, I agree with you. It is very brave writing and so forth. My big criticism is he killed Raymond, which...
It's kill your gaze.
Yes, exactly. I did. So
this was before fridging.
I think fridging is as old as refrigeration itself.
But this is before fridging was
As a concept, yes.
As a concept in comics, and yes,
that's the only thing that brings it down a notch in my mm-hmm. mind. I mean, and he narratively he was trying to up the stakes,
right?
To make North Star's, his
again was the killer killing of a lover or potential lover to spur a hero onto greater things.
Yeah, I mean, this is the second week in a row where that narrative has been.
And it's a trope. It's a trope that's existed in, I mean, Gwen Stacy, hello.
Yes.
Uncle Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's,
Bucky.
We could keep going and going.
And going and going and going. It gets more tricky when you have marginalized characters.
Yes. And I don't think John Byrne's intention was kill your gays. He was using the narrative trope of kill the mentor to spur the hero on to, to not greater things, but what I mean.
Since the character was not specifically noted as such, it was just a friend.
More than a friend.
In bold lettering letters.
It would have got more explicit if it had like a little asterisk and a box at the bottom saying, do you get it? I agree with you though. This is in comic book history, this is an important issue.
I don't know how much is. I tried to do some research, and there are some articles out there about this, but not as many as I thought there would be, and not as much. And I understand that it's tricky because of Byrne, and it's tricky because not all of the language matches to contemporary acceptability. I totally get that, but I just have to look at it in 1983.
Right. And in 1983.
Look at that in 2024.
And in 1983 parlance, this was progressive. So
whether it works now in terms of some of the trickiness of it all, maybe not. But in the same way that you have, queer-coded films in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, that weren't discussed, that when we look back on them now, it's like, okay, that's silly and stereotypical and not helpful. But at the time, it was representation that was not seen otherwise.
No, this is very important. John Byrne, I think, again, correct me if I'm wrong, in mainstream comics, this was the first time anyone had attempted that.
If anybody out there knows of better examples, please let us know, because I'm sure I'm forgetting stuff. I mean, I'm not a historian. I don't have a memory that can immediately pull up an issue from 1962 or 1975 or whatever. I can't do that. I'm not that good. But I would be interested in hearing other examples.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Prove me wrong. I would love it, because I would be fascinated to know more.
Absolutely. Go to our website, collectediedpodcast.com, and leave a comment. This is good stuff, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, Alpha Flight is an entertaining, generic Marvel comic. It has some interesting aspects. It has some interesting characters. Obviously, I think it's important for a couple perspectives, not just North Star, but I think Aurora and Snowbird have some very interesting aspects to them, short of going on for another hour, which nobody wants. It's, I'm kind of glad you picked this over West Coast Avengers, which was my other recommendation, because I feel like this has some historical context that West Coast Avengers, which is fun, doesn't have.
I agree. And, just for my selfish comic book reading, this was something I hadn't read before. So I wanted to do something new. I wanted to read something new, that is, specifically for this issue 7. I knew about it historically, and just from people talking about this run, but I've never read it, so I'm glad I did.
And if anybody has not just alternative opinions on whether this is the first, but whether I am reading this wrong in terms of if I'm wrong in whether this is good representation or not, and I don't mean good representation based on today's standards, I mean representation based on 1983. If I'm wrong there, and if my reading of this is negative towards the experience others have, please let me know. I am absolutely willing to hear and change as I'm educated further.
Absolutely. Yeah. Keep in mind, we're two straight white guys talking about this. So if we're getting something wrong, let us know.
Please, please, please do.
Now, I think Alpha Flight as a whole, having read this for the first time, it's a fun 80s comic. You know, yeah. It's got some fun stuff, and it's got some clever little jokes and commentary. But when you know that Byrne didn't want this assignment and was kind of annoyed that it was given to him, he put that aside and he did some clever things with it and
stepped up to the plate in some, again, particularly with Aurora, North Star, and even Snowbird. He did good for a guy who didn't want to do it.
Yeah. And he did change the terrible name Vindicator to Guardian because he stands on guard for the, you know how they named Canada, don't you, Brian?
I don't.
They threw a bunch of letters into a hat and pulled them out one by one. C-A, N-A, D-A. Thank you very much.
Canada is also home to the best band on the planet, whose name is Cattle. And there's my pimp to my friends in Cattle from Toronto.
I never heard that before.
You have to leave that in. I'm totally pimping for my favorite band.
Awesome. So anyway, thanks for recommending this. I mean, do we have anything else to say about Alpha Flight?
It's part of comics history. It leads into many other things. If you haven't read it, give it a shot. Understand what it is. Understand it's an early 80s Marvel comic with lots of words.
And some pictures missing.
And pictures missing. But if you're a fan of that era, there's absolutely no reason not to give this a shot. It's right in line with many of the other comics from that time. So if you haven't read it and you enjoy all of the other comics from that time, yeah, you're good to go.
Yeah, go for it. And if you're an X-Men fan, this is sort of X-Men North.
It's kind of important if you're an X-Men fan.
Yeah, that was Alpha Flight, everybody.
Hey, so Paul, that was Alpha Flight. What would you like to recommend for our next podcast? It's your turn, my friend.
It is. So next time on an all-new edition of the Collected Edition, we will be reading something a little different. we're going to go extremely light. Yes. Smurf me this one, Mr. Smurf. Now we're going to read
this
the Smurfs.
Smurfalicious.
Yes. We're going to read the Smurfs, the original run of comics by Peyo. Where is he from? He's from Belgium. The original, so Peyo, the Belgian comic book creator, writer and artist who created some of the most annoying characters ever put on film, but the comics are actually kind of fun. I'm not selling this well anyway.
See, yeah. way before the cartoon that we think we know.
Yes, absolutely.
Earlier, this is the original Smurfs.
Yes, this is the original Smurfs that is translated. So these are the ones that were actually released in Belgium and were translated and re-released here, which is what caused all the popularity and then
right. And
the cartoon and the knickknacks and the
whole
films.
The whole thing. This is going to be a vastly different read than what we think it's going to be based on the American version of the Smurfs in the cartoon.
Exactly. And I have chosen, instead of reading just a whole boatload of issues about the Smurfs, I have chosen three stories that I find to be very interesting. We're going to start with the Smurfette, which is the introduction of the female Smurf. And we're going to read Smurf versus Smurf, which is a little civil war between the Smurfs. And then finally, Purple Smurfs, which is sort of Smurf zombies.
Nice.
Yes. So those are the three stories we're going to read. The Smurfette, Smurf versus Smurf, and Purple Smurfs. I don't think we're going to get too deep. This will be, we're talking a little bit off mic, Brian, but you know, this might be akin to our Uncle Scrooge episode, which people seem to like. But anyway, something a little bit light. After The Crow, I needed a palate cleanser.
And we got a little heavy on Alpha Flight there towards the end. So I think this is a really Smurftastic selection.
You're not Smurfing wrong. Let's go Smurfing now. Everybody's learning how. So that's it.
Smurf Safari with me. I mean, I got to finish it.
So thanks again, everybody, for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, and leave us comments and let us know what you think. And you know, all the things we talked about before. Tell us. Let us learn. Anyway, yeah, again, thanks for listening. And until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes